are some people who have something we require. And we want you to get it from them.
You ever kill anybody?
I hurt somebody's feelings once.
You labor or management?
If I was management, I wouldn't have given you a cigarette.
Who and how many are going to be coming after us?
You worried about saving your own skin?
Yeah, I am. It covers my body.
You just can't hold out forever. Impossible.
Oh! Almost a bit raspberry jam right there, eh?
What's the color of the boathouse in here for?
I don't like your attitude.
The color of the boathouse.
Oh, fuck off!
Welcome to Row Min, a 12-episode miniseries on director John Frankenheimer's 1998 espionage thriller, Ronin, starring Robert De Niro, Jean Reno, and of course, written, quite controversially, by one David Mamet and J.D. Zike. I'm your host, Blake Howard. This is episode 10, scene 10 of Row Min, from 1 hour 24 minutes and 1 second to 1 hour 35 minutes and 4 seconds. So when thinking about who to help me on one of the greatest car chases in action cinema and all of cinema history, there was no doubt. Because whenever there is doubt, there's no doubt that the legendary Priscilla Page had to be here, side saddling, lighting me a delicious yellow French cigarette before we chase down Gregor, Seamus, and Deirdre to get us that case. There'll also be a very quick cameo from Maria Lewis, author, prodigious writer, screenwriter, and my friend who you heard at the beginning of the series. So who taught me how to get guests like this? I don't remember. That's the second thing they teach you. Priscilla Page. Oh, God.
Oh, no. What have I done?
Well, sorry. You should cut that.
You just announced my inner monologue.
Oh, God. What have I done?
Oh, so good. So good. Ronan. I know you're...
Ronan.
You are easily, like, the first person that I would ever want to talk to about cars in movies as objects, not only as objects of, like, aesthetic attraction, like, whether it's character embodiments through cars and stuff you've written so greatly about, but particularly movement and chaos. So before we get to, like, one of the most chaotic car chase scenes, and just like chaotic in the fact that like so much of it has got Robert De Niro behind a wheel or Natasha McElhone behind a wheel throughout Parisian underground tunnel chaos. But can you tell me a little bit about your relationship with Ronan? Is Ronan one of your like comfort movies?
I think it has become one somehow. I was actually talking to this girl on Blue Sky. She's like 14 or 15, I think. She's like related to one of my mutuals. And then I started following her. But she and I were talking about Ronan, and she was saying Ronan was one of her comfort movies, which I thought was so cool.
Oh, my God.
And
Shout out to parenting, right? Jesus. I haven't gotten my kids onto that. They're still too young, Priscilla, but the indoctrination's coming. It's coming apart.
I think you should do it because I was like, God, this is, I wish I had been that cool as a teen, because I came upon Ronan like later in life. Like it wasn't something that, it was not my comfort movie as a teenager, but she kind of distilled why that is and had started me thinking about why I kind of like to, it's an action movie, but it's, there's something really soothing about it. It's like almost has like an ASMR quality to it.
Yes.
But it's really like the friendship at the center that is sort of, it's so sweet.
Yeah.
And
it really is.
And like on its surface, it feels very macho. But the more I think about Ronan, the more I actually feel it's anti-macho in some ways.
There's people who are, it detaches macho or like bullshit kind of like gendered stuff to tough. And experienced. Mm-hmm. It's just like, you are tough, you are experienced. And Sean Bean, is the perfect exemplar of like that braggadocious macho.
Yes,
And it
and he
has
gets
nothing,
cut
and it has not, but it has
right
nothing
away.
underneath it, because they d distinguish between who's just tough, who's brave, who like goes into hairy situations, even though they know that they're hairy situations and asked to cover each other's backs. And they do some hairy stuff in this movie. And yeah, I think that that's it's very much like that. There's a sweetness, and it's also, I think there's something I really like, which is, and I think everyone can relate to this. Have you ever been at like work, any job you've ever had, or any interaction? Could be a virtual work, could be in person, doesn't matter what it is. But you just have an interaction with someone and you're like, oh, I like that person. Like, I like that person. That's my kind of person. That's my kind of silly.
Oh,
They
yeah.
said a fun thing. I'm going to talk to that person because they, and it just has that in this movie. It's got this little electric thing of like, oh, I'm going to talk to this guy. He actually knows what he's doing. The rest of these guys I can be suspect on, but that beautiful relationship between Sam and Vincent, Jean Reno and Robert De Niro, of
Yeah.
course, that it's just, I think it's just that thing where you can see someone when you're an adult, you forget how quickly you can become fast friends. And you see that and you're like, oh, we can be fast friends. This is great. I like this guy.
Yeah, there's a recognition. They're almost like soulmates. They're like, oh yeah, this guy. Like,
Well, this guy, I like it.
it has that, it's almost like a Michael Mann quality where it's operating under this veneer of like macho, understated kind of, but underneath there's all this like romance and emotion.
And
There's
just and heartbreak, like, and
mm.
being lost. My friend, I need the money. Like all those implications of like, why are you doing this? We got the money, let's go. It's almost like I've only just thought of it because I saw you. There's a scene earlier in the film where Vincent's like, I've got the money in my pocket. It's almost like the Ilsa Ethan scene from Rogue Nation, where he's like, she's like, there are three options. We do this, we do that. Oh, you just run away with me. You know, it's almost like that. It's like that without any of the Rebecca Ferguson assault on your senses, where you're like, oh God, if she asked me to do that, I'd leave everything behind.
How could you say no?
Still, it's the bravest thing
The
Ethan's done in the entire
least
French.
believable choice he's made.
Yes, crash a helicopter into another helicopter. Sure, absolutely. Run along the Burj Khalifa. Fine. Leave Ilsa with that. Forget it. Not happening.
There is almost like a romantic quality, though, to what Sam and Vincent has, what they have going on. Like, I was thinking at the beginning of this sequence that we are going to talk about, Vincent leans in and like lights Sam's cigarette, and to me, that's such a sexy, intimate, like a trope that I associate with noir, like a man and a woman, you know, lighting each other's cigarette. Sort of feels like an invitation almost. And I just thought, oh, like this, the more I watch it, this, the more I feel that friendship. And it almost has other, I don't know, it really feels, it reminds me of The Killer the more I watch it, like the John Woo
The
Killer.
John Woo killer.
Because I increasingly feel, I used to think that Vincent was maybe French intelligence, but the more I watch, the more I feel like he is a mercenary who possibly used to work for some kind of crime syndicate. So I feel like they're on other sides of the law, but there's still that, like, I mean, even the, I call it like the self-stitch, like that action trope where the hero is so tough, you know, he has to pull a Rambo and like heal his own gunshot wound, you know?
I love
But
DIY surgery in movies. I love it.
yes, I'm such a big fan. It's
And
like my favorite thing.
this is a very good one. This is a very,
Yes.
it's a very good one.
But it's a team effort too, which is, and that also just feels so intimate that like Sam is guiding Vincent through.
And when he says to Vincent, now don't squeeze, don't pull it until you've got it. And he's like, yep, I've got it, I've got it. And then it just slips. And you watch poor Jean Reno's face as Vincent go. And he's like, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. Just do it again, do it again.
I mean, there's a similar scene in The Killer where they're like, I don't know if you remember this, but it's they're by a lake or something, and Chow Yun-fat has a gunshot wound, and the cop is like helping him fix it up, and then they're like, "You're pretty unusual for a cop." and you're pretty unusual for a killer. And you're like, oh, they're falling in love. Like, this is so great.
I love that's what you realize when you hear great interviews or read great interviews with like now John Woo of just how much he appreciates beauty, male or female. He's like, he's beautiful. Just look at this relationship, this friendship. It's beautiful. This moment is beautiful. He's such an appreciator of beauty for a man who orchestrates such beautiful chaos. And in this movie, that's what it does. It does. I'm just trying to think how many of my male friends have lit cigarettes for me as we're talking. I was just like, I would not, I mean, I don't even think,
It's kind of a
or how many have I done? I may have actually lit a cigarette for Jordan up there. I may have lit one for Jordan. I may have. I just think I had, anyway.
See, there has to be a certain amount of closeness, though. It's not like you're just going out there and
No.
lighting random guys'
No,
cigarettes.
I'm not. No, not randomly, guys. No. I don't know who you are, my friend. I'm not lighting a cigarette. I know that you're gonna take it wrong, but if you're
It around, yeah.
standing with a friend and you're like lighting one, you've got the light. You just give them a light. I think that that's what's like cool about the Vincent one is that it start like I actually the when in that first scene, like the cigarette that he saves for him, that he gives him a cigarette and he like takes one and puts it on his ear. Like that's almost that moment is like so firm. It's like, yeah, take a smoke. He's like, you labor or management. He's like, if I was management, I wouldn't have offered you a cigarette. It's just so deep. It's like, yeah, that's your at best middle management is
I
other
love their
management people.
like opening conversations and interactions. They're really lovely. Somehow, like, even though the movie's super understated, and you just have to kind of put all the pieces together yourself. It's never maddeningly so. I can't say that word for some reason, but it's just like, I don't know. I have so much fun like thinking about like, oh, who is that guy really?
And I love what you said. It's something that hasn't come up yet in the conversations that it may have in the series, but it's just like, what's Vincent's background? And when he just says, if it's in Paris, I'll find it. It's just like, there's something about that where it's like, yeah, I don't, he doesn't feel as rigid. He's asking lots of questions, but he's not bad. He's not like Sean Bean who doesn't know. He's like, why don't we go in there? He's like, look at it.
I almost feel like Sean Bean is his character is like a fake on every level. Like he's not even like a real criminal. He's kind of like moonlighting or something, or I don't know. He feels like he's putting on a show, not just But yeah, I feel like every car chase in this movie is almost like a crucible that reveals something about the team. So the first one sort of reveals like he's a fake and he's actually too macho to be on this team and in this movie. We don't want him.
We don't want him. The most
No, but I'm glad
embarrassing,
he lives.
and shameful of fates. You're in a movie
Yes.
with all the these guys, and you're like, you're not one of these guys. Get out of this whole movie. And you're like, oh God, leave. It's the worst.
No. I mean, he has my sympathy, but still, I'm glad
What's the next
he's
one?
out of
What's
there.
the next crucible in that the betrayal, the betrayal, the where it puts everything on Front Street that Stellan
Well, the second
Skarsgård is,
chase reveals that Gregor fucked us.
I love that on a whiteboard. All right, kids, the second chase.
It kind of, I feel like it kind of reveals like who on the team is disloyal or has no honor or something like that.
Yes.
I don't know. And the final one feels like it's there's like a car of men with honor and a car of people without honor or something. I don't know.
And
And
Deirdre's that
they
one in the middle because she's being
but
forced to do this.
none of them give a shit about each other. Like
No.
not even Seamus or Deirdre. Like they just don't care. I feel like Deirdre has there's hope for her yet. Like she's not a complete piece of shit.
No, Seamus doesn't care, but Deirdre's got the case, so she's, I had one of our great patrons and members on our Discord say, excited about the upcoming series. I'm going to watch Ronan and drink every time someone says the word case. And I immediately wrote, do not do that.
You will die.
You will die. An ambulance will have to be sent to your house. So please don't do that.
Are people picking apart what's in the case yet, or is it just me who?
No, we, I've definitely
I
had a
think I
chance.
know.
Okay, please go.
Well, I think, I mean, this is not, I'm not the first person to float this theory, but I think it has to be printing plates for the new euro. Because
Ah,
I
that
can't
is a
think of.
fantastic
Thank you.
theory.
Thank you, Blake.
Fantastic. That's so much smarter than any of the dumb stuff that I thought it might be. I always thought it might be like, you know, maybe it's because I've been Mission Impossible pilled and I'm like, is this some kind of nuclear launch device? Like, is this something that's going to really kick it off? Is it some kind of bomb, like an ultimate like suitcase bomb, thinking of like IRA, they're going to walk that suitcase out the front of Buckingham Palace and just level it and just see what happens. I don't know, but yours is, oh, please expand on that. That's so smart,
Well, I
Priscilla.
worry about the radioactive material because they're just throwing that shit around.
Yeah, true. That is a very valid point. They are just like tossing the
I
bad
mean,
boy around.
I guess it could be codes or something, but it can't be money because they're getting paid a lot to get the money, and that wouldn't make sense.
No.
And so it's like, is it some kind of like, it could be some rare artifact, I guess. It could be worth a fortune, but then again, you still
They're
wouldn't be
tossing
throwing it
that, but
around.
they're putting it in the post. I don't
Drop
think
kicking it, yeah.
it's
Like, what on earth? I just,
printing
so it
plates
feels
for
like
the
it has to
euro.
be.
Because
I
it's, yeah,
think the
it's a license to print money then, right? You just print, print, print.
everyone would want it.
Everyone would want it.
A
And
Interpol, every intelligence agency, every bad guy on the planet.
particularly right on this cusp period
Yes,
where it's
because the
like
Euro came out in 99, but they'd been working on this for a long
they're
time, so
working on the
people would
concept.
know.
That
Yeah, so
the
that's.
wow, that's a great theory.
Thank you. I like the mystery, but there's a part of me that can't stop thinking and wondering and.
Look, and I think it's also because you touched on something which is really interesting just in general.
Did I?
The purest MacGuffin in a Hitchcockian sense, or you know, for more contemporary audiences, like what the hell's in the Pulp Fiction case? Is it Marcellus's soul? Is it gold? Is it whatever, like, you know, whatever people theorize that things are. The best MacGuffins you actually don't need to know, so it doesn't become stressful and annoy the living daylights out of you. But if you're a person like you and I who love like espionage movies and spy movies, big blockbusters, small stuff, all those sorts of things, whenever there is a central object that is the focus of everyone's attention, and because we both like Chris McQuarrie, it's like, why do we keep this thing a mystery? Like the difference between a J.J. Abrams mission is like the rabbit's foot. What is it? We don't know. It's just the rabbit's foot. It's the rabbit's foot. It's bad. And you're like, no, I actually need to know. Like, I need to
I
know.
need some details.
This that like it, this is annoying. Whereas in Ronan, there's a mastery where it's like, if you assume or guess what's on the case, the everyone wanting it actually makes it a curio, but it works even if you don't know what is in it. But that's a very interesting one, and that's the best theory I've heard. And who yourself and those who've triangulated on that theory is such a great one, because it's like, oh, it actually is specific to the time and the place. Because if you need money for an army, for a revolution, and you can print it, then that's really helpful. That's really helpful. You're willing to pay a whole kitty. You're willing to pay all of your savings to get euros, and then buy up any armaments and support people and do all those sorts of things. It's really interesting.
But it's never frustrating that you don't know, that they don't spell
No,
it out for you. Like,
no.
in fact, I like it better. I was actually, I don't know if you've read any of the screenplays or like the drafts rather
I've
for
read
this, but
one of the drafts that has the Mammoth fake name on it.
what was, which one is the Mammoth fake name? Is
What's
it,
it?
it's
It's
not
not.
Zeke or Zike, is it?
No, it's, hold on, I'm gonna find it. It's
Because I read the one with
no, it's
Zeke is the
Richard.
real guy.
Yeah, Zeke is the real guy, but it's the one that's Richard as Richard Weiss. That one. That's the got the mammoth bits in it.
I feel like Mammoth had to, I don't want to be disrespectful, but I feel like Mammoth turned it into something special because like the draft, I haven't read the whole thing, but I was kind of looking at bits and pieces. I was curious about the Jean-Pierre scene.
Yes.
with the figurines, because I was like, oh, that's like such a Frankenheimer. That had to come from him because he had, you probably already know this, but he had like a vast collection of teeny tiny, like, I don't want to call them toys because that feels disrespectful, but they're like models for Ferraris and Porsches. And they had all competed in Le Mans, and he like knew the, I think Ebert interviewed him and kind of watched him like a little kid looking at his like collection. They're in a glass case, and he knew every story for every car. And so I was like, oh, this is such, I was like, what was this like in the script? Like, how did somebody know? Like, it had to have existed in a different form prior to this before Frankenheimer got on board. And true enough, like the scene was, it's like Jean-Pierre and Sam in a barn, and Jean-Pierre has like a gun trained on him, and he's basically interrogating him.
Yes.
I'm like, there's something so lovely about them. Instead of it being so overt and obvious that they're having this kind of, they're sort of, Jean-Pierre is doing most of the sussing out, but they're kind of, it's got kind of the same vibe, but it's in a much more interesting way, you know?
Well, it changes the whole dynamic of who Vincent is as well. It asks you great questions about Vincent, that he takes you to this trusted place. And the guy's so comfortable with the person who just got rolled into his place and he's performed surgery on him that he can
Yeah.
then just sit down while you're having a cup of tea bleeding in front of him and just be painting very rigorously and focused, just painting like in a de-stress kind of way. It's like, I'm not scared. Like, if Vincent brought you, I'm not scared of you. You know, I
Yeah, isn't
repaired you.
that,
It's
it's
really,
also like a 3 Days of the Condor thing, I think,
yeah, very.
where the assassin, is it Max von, is it Sydow or
Yep.
Sydow? I'm just learning now, I don't know.
Sido.
Thank you. I'm just learning now. I don't know how to say that. But his
Yeah,
character, doesn't he have models or something? And so
he's got something.
in my head, like the cinematic language of that suggests to me that this is not necessarily a good guy in conventional terms. Like maybe he's a retired assassin or some kind of criminal, you know?
And then Spielberg just carries him along so beautifully. Michael Lonsdale carries him along
Oh yeah,
into
in Munich, right? Doesn't
Munich.
he have, he's like that character sort of pre-retirement. It's been a long time,
Yeah,
but
he's running a family. He's like, look at us, butcher's hands, him and Eric Bana's character, Avner, butcher's hands,
got to be the same guy, right?
family man. Yeah, it's like Stephen, I need to ask you. I know that this is based on a real book, but that's what he just felt like. This guy lived in this big palatial French home, cooked for his family of jackals, as he calls them. Such a great scene. But yeah, I think that feels very mammoth of like, I know this guy's weird, so how do I give him a thing that makes him more like Frankenheimer? He paints little toys, because it just completely ties into the fable of it, that you guys are the entire fable hinges on him explaining what a Ronin is. You're a soldier without a master, and this masterless society that we're approaching, and it's so deeply political, but it's then mythic at the same time.
Well, I mean, I think that's like, that might be my favorite line when he says, like, they chose honor, they chose myth, and then De Niro says, they chose wrong. This is like such a cool, I don't know, the movie, it's just that whole screenplay, like, the dialogue just feels like poetry to me. It's just so beautiful.
It completely is elevated in all the quietest moments, because, and it's also just the delivery, how well people just deliver absolute stone cold classic lines across the board. It's not just De Niro, and then just let them breathe.
Yeah,
There's
they
not a
all seem to fundamentally understand somehow how to deliver the lines in the way that I would love them the most, personally.
All the way from Skip Sutter's, my favorite. Well, I think it's becoming my favorite line. You're American? Like, after not realizing that Daenerys is just speaking French to Jean Reno. American? Such an adorable line.
Yeah, I love that guy. I think that guy, Skip, the actor who's, is it Suddoth?
Yeah,
How do you
Sutter.
say his
That's how
last name?
that's how I pronounce it. ever since
This
I've
is
known
always,
Larry.
podcasts are so revealing. I never
They are,
know.
because you
I
read,
have his,
especially if you read
what?
interviews of people so many times, or
Yeah.
you're like an IMDb freak like you and I, like you just go, Suddeth, Sudeth, Sudeuth? I
Well, it has
don't
that kind of like tricky, like Welsh or Irish look that you're like, this is pronounced vastly
know.
different than the way I'm saying it. But yeah, I think that guy did all his own driving. Somebody on Blue Sky was kind of, they were trying to say they love the movie, but it sounded like they were making fun of it, and they were saying like, the cars aren't cool, the men aren't cool. And they're like, this guy keeps making weird faces in the car chase. And I was like, leave Skip alone. Like he's doing his own driving.
Are you ready for more independence as a financial advisor? Consider the RIA model. Schwab Advisor Services has helped thousands of advisors make the move. To find your path, start with Schwab at advisorservices.schwab.com/paths today.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. That is, speaking of the Parisian car chase, that is the thing that I think someone like Christopher McQuarrie is really carried, carrying the torch for this. It's like you have the
Oh, yeah.
guys driving because they pull all the faces. Like De Niro and Taxi Driver can be cool, aloof, psychopathic, detached, all the wonderful emotions you can associate with Travis Bickle in that front of that car and strange and, on another, plane of existence, whatever. But watching De Niro, like his face scrunch up going around a corner at like 100 miles an hour.
Oh, he is not driving though.
No, there's the
I
guy
have to
that's
expose him.
it's the guy next to him, but at least
Yeah.
in the car, or
But the
like in
terror is real.
that's exactly what I was about to say. It's like
Yeah, sorry.
having someone in the car actually experiencing that, even though they're not. It's the same with Natasha McElhone, who did a bunch of her driving, but then some of the more
Yeah.
hairy scenes. She's obviously got someone driving in like a dual control car, but her hair whipping around and her being scared and the chaos of
Hot
that,
sweat, yeah.
it's just that's when you go back and you're like, this is tactile. Like there is a person in that car. And if you're ever lucky enough in your entire life to like go and do a I went with a friend. It was his like birthday. His wife bought him like a hot lap in a rally car, and a couple of friends got to go along with him. It was like an hour. You got to go there, you drive around with a driver, and then they take you and you drive like one tiny lap. You're going like 20 kilometers an hour, like 10 miles an hour compared to them. They're going 100, but you're going like around this rally course. And I remember just what it was like, just like my face in that car, like when I was sitting in the passenger seat with the real driver and how fast they were going. And then when
Yeah.
they were encouraging me to drive around like my little hot lap, they're like, put your foot down, put your foot down. And I'm like, it's down. They're like, put your foot down. Put your foot down. I was like, oh my God, it's very stressful. So that the stress that reads on those actors is what elevates it, because it's like it doesn't feel like these are immediately you get out of the sort of the cockpit of the car, if you like. It's you don't get out, you're in it, and they're in it, and they're being whipped around. It's the Top Gun Maverick. It's the it's that sort of thing where you can feel the tactile people's faces being squished and moved around. It's electric. It's so great.
Yeah, visceral.
Yes.
And it kind of, I feel like this chase is as much a culminate, like a climax of the movie as it is kind of a culmination or like apotheosis of the friendship with Sam and Vincent.
Yes.
Whereas like, I was gonna call it like a almost like a trust exercise, but I feel like they've gotten past that point
Yes.
and now they're like bonded.
Completely
And
in sync. Yep.
Vincent is the one who's like the tour guide.
Yes.
But it's Sam who's in the driver's seat, and it seems like he just trusts him implicitly to like not kill them. I mean, I was trying to think like, who would I trust to drive me around Paris or anywhere like that, you know? Like maybe Tom Cruise. But I
Fine.
can't think of
Done. Tom Cruise, sold.
Yeah, exactly. I would feel so safe, but I
Oh,
think
yeah.
with anybody else, like any, I can't pick any of my own friends who I would trust not to get us killed, you know?
Yeah, there's
I don't want to
definitely,
ruin any friendships,
there's
but
definitely, I can't speak to my American friends because I haven't driven around with them as much. I trust the driving of Katie Walsh, but we never were going 100 miles an hour racing through streets, so
yeah,
I haven't. But
exactly.
my friends in Oz, I'm like going through the list. I'm like, oh no, I wouldn't get that, but
Not this fucking guy.
no. Yeah, there's very few. There's very few that you're not like
Yeah.
immediately grabbing onto the handle in the front of the car, going like, "Oh, this person's gonna kill
Throwing
me."
up.
This
Yeah,
person's
but
gonna kill.
Vince just doesn't, Vincent does not look stressed. I mean, he looks a little bit nervous, but he's not, you know, grabbing the door handle or anything, like trying not to throw up,
He's trying
which
to
is, I
shoot.
think, what I would be doing.
He's trying to get a gun. He's trying to shoot them. He's trying to shoot them as they're driving through those scenes.
And then
That's.
I think they kind of had to do the same thing with like De Niro, where they had to convince him to trust them. I don't know if you've heard
Yeah.
the story
Yeah, I've
already,
heard it. No, please
but you know
recount it
they
for the show. Yeah.
okay, well, basically De Niro started to get really stressed out, and so they had to figure out the important thing I should mention is that every single stunt car driver involved is a race car driver. So it was a guy named I'm probably saying his name fucked up, but Lanier
Yeah.
is how I believe it's pronounced. But he was basically, he's a race car driver, and he actually worked with Remy Julien, who is the guy, I think he's like one of the best who's ever done it. Like he did the Italian Job
Yeah.
chase, and he made it not just so that it ruled, but also that like nobody died. Like he just they there's just so much attention paid to safety. So anyway, these race car drivers, I think like Frankenheimer says there's 300 race car drivers involved in this chase. Like they have complete control. Like every car involved is being driven by a professional. But yeah, so Lanier was the one driving the Peugeot with which is, I don't know why I hate that car name, but this just sounds gross. But so he's driving that car with De Niro in it, because the steering wheel is fake. De
Yeah.
Niro's steering wheel is fake, and so his he has a little like tiny reel,
Race
a
car
real
driver, a
wheel.
race car
Yeah,
driver
yeah.
steering wheel on the one side of the car.
Yeah, so De Niro started to freak out, basically, now that I've gone on this little tangent. And they had Frankenheimer first got in the car with them to try to show him like it's okay, but also go maximum speed. And I don't think De Niro liked that. So then they had Frankenheimer's wife get in the car to show him that it was cool. And after they were done with that, like she had a great time. So it was kind of like, well, you know what? If she had a good time, you can have a good time, right? So that was like the test. They had to prove themselves to De Niro. And somehow, I don't think there were any injuries reported, even though, like, a lot of those, I think that like exploding cop car actually has a guy in it. But somehow no one was harmed.
What's so magical is, yeah, no one was harmed. They were driving around on through Parisian tunnels around the time that Princess Diana's tragedy happened in prison tunnel. They're orchestrating all of this chaos. And talk about a work, like a wife perk or a husband perk, to go to work with your other half and be like, sit in the car with a race car driver. They're going to drive you like 100 miles an hour through this tunnel. And you go like, sick, I can't wait. And you just
I'd be
go,
so happy.
oh, it'd be the greatest day of all time. I'd be like, this is the best perk ever. But I totally get it. It's like, yeah, it's hairy. It's a different kind of filmmaking. And Natasha McElhone does a great interview where she described Frankenheimer, and she's like, look, I thought he was excited when all of the actors were performing and saying this great dialogue. She's like, but then when this older man was having us race through Paris, she's like, I realized, oh, he was just excited for us to be done so that we could get to the car chase. And I just love that giddiness. He was so happy that they did it. And yeah, there's great race car, like Michael Schumacher, one of the most famous F1 drivers of all time, there's a hilarious story that him and his family were in the center of Paris and they had to get to Charles de Gaulle Airport and they were running late. And he got down to a cab and he asked the driver if he could drive. And it's about a 40-minute-ish drive out of Paris, 40 minutes to get to Charles de Gaulle. And I think Schumacher did it in like 18. And just drove his whole family. He's like, I can take my family. I'm not scared. Strap yourselves in. We're going in this cab. And he drove. And so it's just so hilarious to me that not only were Ronan, but like Michael Schumacher was running late to the airport with his family one day and drove like an absolute lunatic, I would imagine, to get to the airport and then pulled up with his family. He did get into a little bit of trouble, but there was no car accidents. He didn't cause any accidents. He just probably blew past every human being on the road at a breakneck speed.
Jesus Christ. Story of Rendezvous, right? Which I think has to be like a huge. There's somebody was. I had already established that, like, I was having a conversation with someone online and I was like, oh, I'm sure Frankenheimer had to be influenced by this. It's like a really short film by Claude Lelouch, Cité en Rendezvous.
No, I haven't seen it.
Oh, shit. You should really.
Oh, shit.
You should really find this and watch it because it's Lelouch is in his own car. I think it was a Mercedes, but he dubs in the sound of an engine or a Ferrari because he thought it would sound better. But it's like he just strapped a camera to the front of his car and drove through Paris like in the morning. And I think he blew through like maybe 18 stoplights. And somehow nobody got killed, which is a miracle. But it's like the best, it's not even a car chase and there's no, you never see the car that's driving because the camera's strapped to the hood the whole time.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's really, exhilarating to watch because you feel like, I feel that in a car chase, I want to either feel like I'm in the driver's seat or I'm getting run over by the car.
Yes.
but I feel like that's the camera being placed at that level, the camera's like strapped to the bumper. And I feel like, so Frankenheimer uses that placement quite a bit in this chase, which is like my favorite, but also like the locations that he uses. And, the car that he drove was like a 76 Mercedes. And, Frankenheimer uses the exact same type of car in the second chase.
Yes.
And so I'm like, there is no way. And I know for a fact that it was like a huge influence on Macquarie for the Fallout chase. And the Fallout chase is, in my opinion, like, if not the best, one of the best car chases of the 21st century. And I just feel like Rendezvous is sort of like a, I don't know if I want to use the phrase platonic ideal.
Yeah.
But it's like, if you're going to draw from something,
draw from
it's
the best.
Be
draw from draw from something that's pure magic, caught, and then edited together. Yeah, the Macquarie Fallout chase, particularly Ethan on that motorbike driving around the Arc de Triomphe, even crossing the road at the Arc de Triomphe is insane. But then watching him ride the opposite direction in traffic to navigate to one of the potential exits around the Arc de Triomphe and then down Parisian streets on cobblestones is absolutely stupid, but it's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah, I was actually having this conversation about like, is Paris the best location for a car chase? Like, is that the best city in the world? Because
Could
it might
be.
be, because it's so hellish,
I think
you
Rome,
know?
is close, but they could never block the streets. Rome
Yeah.
is chaos, Priscilla.
Well,
Rome, I
yeah.
remember going to Rome and they're like, use locals as human shields when you're crossing the road. There's like six lanes of traffic. It's like six lanes of traffic, and then this delightful, like, sweet old lady with like a little cart will just like walk out on, like, because the pedestrian crossings don't slow down at pedestrian crossings. They just drive through them, zoom, 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 a bunch of
Jesus
Italians.
Christ.
And then you just watch this little sweet old duck like wander down with her little cart from the supermarket or from the market, and all the cars just stop. Zoom. And if you're a tourist, you're like, human shield, just go stand next to the old lady, walk across, please don't die, get to the other side of the road immediately, zoom, 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 like starts. I think Rome might be more chaotic. But that, I don't think that you could orchestrate it in the same way because it doesn't have the same infrastructure as Paris. Paris is bigger.
Yeah, I mean, I can't,
But
I'm no expert on that
I
part,
would say
but
it's close. I would say it's
it's
close.
pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Somehow, like, I was listening to this little thing that Lanier has, like, it's like a 10 or 15 minute video that I'd never seen before, and he just talks about how, like, the police chief somehow was just like, yeah, let them do whatever they want, like, they have carte blanche basically. I'm like, this is insane. But, like, you know, this is something that I was mentioning before we recorded, is that I think George Miller's the god of the car chase, but Frankenheimer is one of the kings, which also includes Macquarie and Friedkin. But Friedkin was really reckless, from what I remember, like,
Yeah, the
for
French
that
connection
French, yeah, he's
is
like,
like
permits, who cares?
no permits, live traffic, chaos.
Yeah,
The only reason
yeah.
why that's good is because it's so chaotic and you can't believe that they actually did it
And survived.
and survived and no one got killed. That's
Yeah.
the miracle of it. Whereas George Miller has that thing where some filmmakers, and it's so fun listening to great filmmakers talk about other great filmmakers, but some filmmakers are like, and I think it was like Soderbergh. He's like, I don't know how people didn't die. Like, I just don't understand. George, you have to explain to me how you did that and no one died. Like, especially like those guys who you literally see jump off a truck. Like, the war boys, a war boy jumping off a truck into a car and then that car facilitating an explosion. And even if they swap it out for dummies, just the first bit of the guy jumping off of something into a car that's going like 80 kilometers an hour, which is like 60 miles an hour, 70 miles an hour through the desert. It's like, how's that guy not dead? I always have this funny
Yeah,
feeling
exactly.
where George Miller's like, no, he's a war boy. He sacrificed himself to get to Valhalla. It's cool.
For our film to
For
look
our film.
good.
Yeah, I had all these guys drinking chrome and they did some stuff. And, we have there's some desert funerals that were undertaken for these blessed war boys to go to Valhalla.
But you know, as a person who loves car chases, I respect it so much when the orchestrators of them care about safety.
Yeah.
Like, I
Yeah.
lose so much respect. I don't want to be specific because I don't want to be, it feels ghoulish, but there's, like, you know, when you hear about certain movies that weren't all that good to begin with, and you know, a stunt driver gets killed for something stupid, you're like,
No. And
why? Why did this have to happen?
also stunties are so good that it's so neg like if you ever met a stuntie, they're just the best. And they know how to do
Yeah.
all the things. And so for stuff to be so negligent that, and like George Miller is guilty of this in a big way in the early Mad Max films, where they're like flip cars and do these things. And very fortunately at the time, there was kind of this like rogues gallery of amazing Australian emerging stuntmen that did some of the crazy stuff and made their whole careers and then went off and go, okay, we're never doing that again, but like we'll do go and do other stunts,
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree with you. It's there's something where people are at such a high level that they can orchestrate all the chaos and make it fun, but never make it something that like is some garish death video that you are unwittingly
Yeah.
watching.
Yeah.
But he's a great filmmaker in that respect. He would have just been eating up that preparation and those stunties and European race car drivers on holiday. going to drive through the Parisian streets and cause chaos with Robert, you know, some of them with Robert De Niro in the bloody car. Like, that's just amazing.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I just respect so much that they had such attention to like everybody's in a safety harness and they rehearsed. I mean, it looks like somebody had to have died in the bit where they're going the wrong way.
Yeah.
But I think the cars coming toward them are going like 35 miles per hour. And the rule was, you know, they have to hit their marks and make sure like nobody gets out of the lane that they're in. And then the cars are actually going 70, the main cars are going like 75 miles per hour toward them. But since they know what they're doing and they've rehearsed, you know, they can like figure, they
There's
know like
lines.
where
If
to
you
dodge
people,
in and out.
yeah, there's gaps that they've opened up for them.
Yeah, so it, to me, it looks like the worst thing that's ever happened, but and someone is definitely going to die, and you feel that way the whole time, but it's still like the safest. I mean, I would even say like race car drivers are like a step above your average. I mean,
No offense to a stunt driver, but if you drive, if you're a race,
well,
if you're a driver in the F1,
yeah.
if you're in
They're
like,
used
even
to
if,
going way faster than that, and they're like, this is
yes,
nothing.
yeah, like 180 miles an hour.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to, I think that we've, this is like talking in 90s terms, though. I don't want to disparage any current stunt drivers because I feel like a lot of them have that background and they do know what they're doing now. Like, I think we've come a long way, but back then, for sure, it was like, you know, would I rather have like some schmuck from America or would I rather have like a French race car driver?
Driving on the streets
You
he grew
know?
up on, probably, and has commuted
Yeah,
on. So it's also
exactly.
like, you know, the terrain. It's a very, I'm not slighting anyone. I'm just saying, like, they're operating. This is what I also appreciate talking to you now, Priscilla, is like, I think the difference is for people to appreciate is like, F1 drivers at top speeds can, your eyes can't even adjust to how fast you're going, and you're anticipating your turns before you do them because you're going so fast that you have to turn before your body is telling you where the turn is. And so it's
Yeah.
this weird, like, detached anticipatory reflex function that you have when you're driving so fast to turn the car. In no controlled circumstances, it's chaos. There's other cars around you, they're trying to battle for you. The pressure of the heat and the G forces sitting in the cars, it's insane. And so then
Yeah.
if you're like, hey, drive 70, they're like, yeah, I got this, man. It's fine. 70. They're like,
Yeah.
fine. Okay.
In the meanwhile, De Niro's having a heart attack
Yeah.
in the
Because, and
passenger
that is
seat.
absolutely the right response to that amount of chaos. Yes.
Yeah. And I think in some cases they're getting towed. Like, I feel like it's been a while, but I think the Frankenheimer commentary, he says they're getting towed by some kind of Mercedes or whatever.
Yeah, there's a couple of moments where they're being towed, and it's not, it's integrated so beautifully that it's not apparent, but it's like there's a couple of brief moments where they're being towed because it's often the interiors where you can see all the parties
Yeah.
because there's not a person that is like wedged next to Natasha McElhone under the under the dashboard driving, you know. It's not that, those ones where someone's like, she's got her hands on a wheel. They're being towed through in certain situations again for that safety
Yeah.
moment. And then it pops
You
back
could see the
to,
flop sweat.
yeah, pops back to the chaos.
My favorite rig is when they're like on top of a car driving.
Yeah.
It looks
Yeah.
really.
The funnest job. The funnest job ever.
Yeah, I know. I wouldn't want it, but yeah.
No, absolutely not. No.
I feel like those people are like a different species almost. Like I can't even
War
imagine. I
boys.
can't
War
fathom.
boys. That's they all. They
Yeah.
all came to Australia, shaved their heads, painted themselves white, worked for George Miller.
Yeah, basically. Oh, I wanted to talk a little bit more about, I just wanted to say the one thing I wanted to say at the beginning is like that script is so, I wanted to read this to you. You can cut this if you want it to, but the beginning, like when of this sequence when De Niro has a line that's like,
Under the bridge, by the river. How did you know it was an ambush?
Whenever there is any doubt, there is no doubt. That's the first thing they teach you.
Who taught you?
I don't remember. That's the second thing they teach you.
To me, that's almost like a confession of who he is. Like, he's basically telling his homie, like, I'm a cop, you know?
Yeah.
And it's so understated that it was almost a jump scare when I saw the original draft. I don't want to say that would have been a bad movie, but it would have been a vastly different one. But this is the conversation. I actually put it in my notes because,
oh, great.
I want you to experience how different this movie could have been. Sam just straight up says, I'm a field agent, last of an already extinct breed. Oh. I do dark ops. And then he has to explain what dark ops are. Wet work, kidnapping, assassination. Vincent says, very ugly. And Sam says, it is at that. And then Vincent says, not very zen of you, huh? Not so much the modern samurai after all. And it's like, what? I don't need all this. Like, the line that he delivers is so perfect. And there's, you know, and then I think Vincent says something like, who are they? And he's like, I don't remember. And you're like, oh, shit. Like, yeah. He's, you know, CIA or something.
He's like, yeah. Yeah. He goes, who are they? I don't remember. That's the second thing they teach you. Like, that's,
yeah.
It's perfect. It's perfect. Oh, God.
Yeah, that's all I need to know.
That's like just, this in this moment, we don't need the exposition. The mystery is about these people, too. It's who these people are is as interesting as what's in that case. Maria Lewis is back. Tell me about what you love about this, because I know how much you love action cinema, but I'd love if you could tell the people listening.
I love action cinema. I love car shit. Fast and Furious, my second favorite franchise of all time.
What's your first?
It's Universal Movie Monsters.
Oh, that's a
hello.
Great. She's an enigma. I was kind of like,
you're like, wait, what could you possibly love? What is
possibly more than Fast and Furious? Yeah.
But the thing that I think.
Huge fan of The Mummy with Tom Cruise.
Oh, don't.
Russell Crowe.
Don't bring that up again. You know, I got hired to work on that Dark Universe and then everybody was fired 3 days later after The Mummy came out. I literally got my dream job on a Thursday and then we had all been fired by the Sunday. So anyway, I actually do quite like that movie, but it's a sore spot for me. But the thing with Ronan that's so interesting about, and this scene in particular, is we talked previously about how lots of films have eaten Ronan's lunch, or like paid homage, right? Quite respectfully, and great, genuinely great filmmakers, whether that's like your Chris McQuarrie's or your Chris Nolan's or other people called Chris. But the thing about Ronan that I feel like is one of those things about modern action films that is genuinely and sincerely missing, and you really feel the void and you really feel the absence, is the real world geography and the real world machinations. We were watching E.T., you and I, the other day, and I was like, fuck me, look how many extras are in this shot. And it was just a shot on the street. And it's something that I really appreciate, especially action scenes, when they have depth of field and when you can see multiple streets in the background and when there's a real tangible physical place. I think what's so tricky about action scenes and what I find disquieting when I watch a lot of action cinema at the moment is you've really lost a sense of place. It's really physically unclear about where you are, and especially with car stuff, that's part of the genius of Mad Max Fury Road, is you're always really clear physically where you are and where the enemy is and where this threat's coming from and that threat, right? He draws really interesting, clear visual lines because it's a desert. So he has a quite easy playing.
He's got a nice canvas to work with. He's not worried about
literal one of place. The worst cities in the world ever to drive, especially in the 90s after the Queen, whoever had killed Princess Di, like who could say? But that is just so fascinating to me because even like the amount of physical cars that have to be in that scene, the speeds that they're driving at, even other moments in Ronan, like the first sort of when they try to ambush the case in route and there's a moment where they veer off roadworks and they go off road and
they're going so fucking fast, and there's a shot where you see the cars, like the suspension on those bitches flying around. And like, these are just sedans, basically. And even like De Niro trying to shoot the bazooka out of the sunroof, and whoever that poor stuntie is like fucking getting whipped back and forth. Like, they're moving and traveling at speed in actual physical cars and actual physical places in a way that when you see it at the time, you're like, oh my God, this scene is crazy. And you kind of expect it to go for 45 seconds. And then it's a minute, and then it's 2 minutes, and it's still going, and it's still just as compelling and breathless. And like, I mean, shout out to fucking Deidre's hair. Like, you want to talk about hairography? This is why like equality in film is important, because like De Niro, no disrespect, one of our great actors, but as he's like going from side to side and whipping side to side, it's just not as dramatic and visually interesting as her beautiful blow waves getting whipped from side to side to side in various like versions of cashmere and whatnot. And that is the thing, is like, that blew me away about that scene, but why it's one of my favorite scenes from the movie, but why also like lots of scenes from Ronin that people come back and pick from. Even the finale, again, another great example of just the actual technical savvy that is required to make that scene function and work when there are literally so many moving parts, is just like genuinely mind-blowing. Like, it really takes not just a great director, it takes great heads of department across the board. It takes great stunties. It takes great planning. It takes great cinematography. It takes great like local production managers and local, I don't even know what the right word would be for the Paris version. Here it's like your state government film agency.
Whatever your film body is, to be like, we're going to block off X amount of streets.
To even hire those streets. I mean, there's a reason lots of stuff up until the year of our Lord 2025, there's lots of stuff that hasn't shot in Australia specifically because it's too expensive to shoot on streets here. It's like cheaper to film a street in fucking LA of all places, well, not even LA, Atlanta of all places, than it was to hire a street here and shut it down and film something. And then you start to see this shift with something like The Fall Guy when that happens, and it has that amazing scene that goes over the Sydney Harbour Bridge, and it's all going through the CBD, and it's like, God, that scene and that moment in Fall Guy is special, and it's all orchestrated by stunties, and the whole film is really about physical, tactile filmmaking, that when you do see it in something like Ronin, you're like, that just, sorry, that doesn't exist. It kind of stopped 3 years after this, and we just didn't do it anymore. And I tell you what, a fucking, like, there's a big difference. You look at the Fast and Furious movies from like 1 to 7. I feel like 7 is when the shift started. It looks like shit.
Yeah.
They don't have like physical cars physically driving places anymore. You have a car and then you have a green screen on either side and you're like, what is happening?
Yeah. It's the great thing about John Frankenheimer as a filmmaker is like him as the leader.
Is everything.
Like, well, is kind of everything, but it's him as the leader of this production because he's famously one of his like towering movies that a lot of people have been influenced by and a lot of people may have seen if you're a cinephile is Black Sunday. And and so,
you know me, girl. I love a Thomas Harris.
Yeah, so it's a Thomas Harris adaptation, and it's about a terrorist who's crashing a blimp into the Super Bowl. And at that time,
what a great word, blimp.
Robert Shaw is the lead character of that movie, and John Frankenheimer was, I believe, the first and only filmmaker ever that was ever allowed to shoot at a live Super Bowl. So, like, Robert Shaw's character is looking for, you know, this terrorist activity, trying to figure out, like, where this guy's going to do. They don't actually realize that it's going to be a blimp crash. They just think it's going to be a bomb or something like that. And there's such amazing scenes that, like, literally when I watched it, there's a really great physical media release from Imprint. When I was watching it, I was like, I rewound it and rewound it again because I just couldn't believe the crowd. I was looking at the crowd and I'm like, that's a real game. You know, you do that second screen thing where you start Googling, like, did Black Sunday shoot at a real Super Bowl?
Think about The Fugitive when they're running through that St. Paddy's Parade. And that is basically...
That's an elite... They snuck that. They stole that.
But that's what I'm saying is, like, Black Sunday, Fugitives in between, and then Ronin's, like, on the other side of that is, like... Those moments just don't happen anymore where there are massive crowds and like orchestration and like I love the planning of it all. It's just crazy. Little tiny wee pivot. Did you ever read the book that Black Sunday is based on, also called Black Sunday?
No.
So Thomas Harris, one of my favorite authors, like in the world, Red Dragons, one of my favorite books. The thing that really sticks with me about Black Sunday is there's a terrorist chickie who's like seducing a guy to basically like badge her way into Blimp City. and she's got a mad bush. That's the thing. Because it comes so early in the book and they're like, yeah, and she had this massive bush. And I was like, what a fascinating detail. Like, this woman is like a schemer, and like this whole plan is so elaborate and it takes so much to pull off. And they're like, also, just while you're there, huge bush. Anyway, they're like, that's my Black Sunday, her bush.
That concludes episode 10 of our series on Ronin by John Frankenheimer. Ronin, a huge thank you as always to my two amazing guests. Firstly, the great Priscilla Page, an incredible film mind. Follow her online, support her on Patreon. Just all the work she does is so thoughtful and dutifully researched. Love her work so much, and she's a great friend. And my bestie, Maria Lewis, prodigious author, screenwriter, and pull quote machine. Guys, if you're enjoying everything that we're doing here at One Heat Minute Productions, go over to oneheatminute.com. You can find out everything about our show. If you have a little bit of extra scratch to support us, go over to patreon.com/oneheatminute. You can get bonus episodes of our show, The Decade Project, which is a 10-year review show. You can also join our film club, The Juice, where we give you a curation with a special jury. And there's a special tier on our Patreon where you can become part of the jury to make those selections. We'll catch you on the next episode of Ronin very, very soon.
Are you a financial advisor considering the independent RIA model and wondering where to start? Start with Schwab Advisor Services. They've helped thousands evaluate the full range of options and can help you determine your best path forward. Start your journey today at advisorservices.schwab.com/paths.